right, welcome everybody. We're coming to you from Multiverse 2020, Multivirtual, our online convention. We'll start out this panel. This is our guest of honor hour with the awesome Liz Gorinsky. We'll start out by introducing who's here on the panel. I'm Jesse Adams. I am the co-chair of Multiverse Convention and co-host of Glitchy Pancakes podcast.
I'm Rob Gilmore. I'm a co-host of Glitchy Pancakes podcast and a lifelong lover of Multiverse. And I'm also involved with Multiverse as well.
And I'm Allie Charlesworth. I'm co-chair of Multiverse and co-host now of Glitchy Pancakes. So,
yes. And with us, as we mentioned, we're really excited and honored to have with us our 2020 industry guest of honor. Liz Gorinsky is the Hugo and Alfie Award-winning editor, founder of Erewhon Books, which is an independent publisher focused on novel-length speculative fiction. Liz started her career at Tor Books, editing a list of popular and highly acclaimed works by authors like Mary Robinette Kowal, Sherry Priest, Liu Cixin, Annalee Newitz, Catherine M. Valente, Jeff Vandermeer. She was also part of the founding team of Tor.com and edited comics and short fiction there for many years. Welcome, Liz. Liz Gorinsky.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, we are super excited to have you here because this is editing stuff in particular is like not a lot of people really know, like get a peek behind the curtain and really get to see what that world is like. And it's, I know, especially for like for our writer people, but for everyone else as well, it's like they really want to know what happens behind the scenes.
Yeah, we'll try not to make it too scary.
I think that's something that especially a lot of writers are always like, just because they spend so much time just having sent something out into the ether and, you know, waiting for it to be accepted or rejected, or if they've already, if it's, you know, if an editor's working on it. I hear so often from writers about that thing where they're biting their nails, just waiting for it to come back and waiting to say, are you going to come back and say, oh, I hated it, it was terrible, you need to put this in the shredder and start over.
I love writers dearly, but there is like an ability to fixate on a thing that they can control. There's like, let's like think very deeply about what salutation I'm going to use. And I'm like, I am thinking about so many things that are not what salutation you're going to use, I promise.
Yeah, that's not going to make or break them in your eyes. Hopefully getting the right salutation. Well, why don't we start out and talk about your most recent venture, Erewhon Books. This is really interesting because what I was personally curious about is after so many years working as an editor, what made you want to take the leap and kind of like hang out your own shingle and go into like the full scale publishing?
Yeah, absolutely. I was at Tor basically my entire adult career. Before that, I did one internship in the industry, which is DC Comics, and then a long time at Tor. And it was great, but it's like I guess it was a combination of publishing is intensely cyclical. We had a three-season schedule. So just imagine doing the same thing three times a year for 15 years. And like, even if it's doing a thing like working on books that you love, like it is, you know, kind of repetitive in some ways. And and I think it was also, you know, many great things were going on. But I think that like around the time that I was working there, there was like, I guess, a drive towards becoming a little bit more professional and a little bit more corporate. And I think ultimately to the benefit of the company, but I felt like sort of cowboy territory when I started, that we were just like a bunch of science fiction weirdos, and they still are to be sure, but there was also kind of a like, let's fit a little bit more into the greater Macmillan culture. And so I was basically at the point where I could consider kind of working independently for a little while. So I was attempting to leave and go freelance and try to do some freelance editing for a while, to focus on some other things that I was interested in exploring, just not do the same thing over and over again for a little while. And then some folks found me and said, hey, would you like to start a new speculative fiction company that will be funded and you can do whatever you want, basically? And I spent a little while wrestling with imposter syndrome about that. And then basically enough people said some variations on how can you not do that, that I kind of figured that I had to do that. and that's where we started. And it's been about 2 years. It definitely doesn't feel that long. And I think that's partially because in addition to building up a press and the fact that publishing takes a long time, we're also just like starting a company from the ground up. And like, so all of that, you know, kind of takes a little while, but we're finally at the point where we've got some books out in the world. Our first book came out in March, actually like the first week that we were in national lockdown from the pandemic. So it's been a strange year, but we wound up postponing a few books for a little while, partially to figure out kind of how to better publish into this arena. And now we had our, you know, second book came out last month, and the third one will be coming out a week from now, a week before you'll be seeing this, basically. So we're starting to get things rolling, but it still feels very new in the grand scheme of things because new things are happening every day.
Yeah.
So how is it going in the time of Corona? What's changed for you?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of it is the in-person interaction, and that's true in every case, but I think that it's the biggest things are going to be basically like, you know, not going into an office. We were a small team, but we did kind of work together all in New York, and now we are spread across the country. And so learning to, you know, kind of just manage people that are not in your space and or work with people that are not in your space. And we have a... Previously, we have a distributor that we work with, and we would go to all their meetings in person and like just basically like be aware that there was a larger company that was supporting us. And then the larger industry, we would go to booksellers conferences, librarians conferences, go to international rights fairs in Frankfurt and London, science fiction fantasy conferences. I would, you know, be in Atlanta in a week from now in a normal world. And all of that has just stopped. So it's, I think we have our fair share of virtual meetings and trying to figure out the virtual convention thing, but that is a big change. In-person bookselling, that for, I would say, the first 4 or 5 months, like just retail was not existing in a lot of different places. And now it's still in a vastly different shape. So very quickly that changed from, it used to be like some amount of the buying public would walk into a store and browse and like pick up something that looked exciting. Mm-hmm. And now almost all of that is gone. And so one of the things that has shifted there is that it's harder to get traction as some of the tricks that you used to get traction as a writer that's not already a bestseller are just gone. They're off the table right. Because you can't get somebody picking up and being like, oh, I like this cover and here's some interesting mm-hmm. blurbs. It's a lot of people that are buying what they know they want already. So right. as an indie publisher, we don't have a publisher name that people know yet. And we don't have author names that we're doing a lot of debuts and a lot of like people that are doing new things. So it's definitely like we're having to work a lot harder, I think, to just like make sure that people are noticing the things that we're doing. And right. we're not, you know, existing publisher with 50,000 Twitter followers. We just are like kind of building our fandom now, let's say.
Are there any benefits to having to do this type of business while you're, you know, at home or dealing with the virus?
Let's see. I mean, I think, you know, some of it is just the way that we work. And like when I when I'm editing, I need to be in kind of an intensely insular place. And so, you know, it used to be that I would kind of have to either stay home for those periods or carve away time. And so there's always something nice about just like not having anybody kind of watch what you're doing at all. I can like tune out for a few hours and be like, okay, now I'm going to focus on this type of work and then get back to that. And, you know, we're learning new tricks. And like, I think that figuring out kind of what's really necessary. Do we need to have a sales conference for our distributor or wherever sales rep comes from around the country. So we miss the part where we get to talk to people face to face and schmooze. But then there's some ways where when you're presenting a list of books and you can do a PowerPoint presentation and people get to make commentary and talk to each other in the chat, like there's something nice about that. So I think a lot of it is, like I think all of the accessibility of book events has increased massively. That for a long time, like authors would, first of all, it's expensive to send people places. So unless you're a really huge author, you can go to 3 or 4 places maybe. And then right. you get the 20 to 40 people that live in that town that are like sort of ordinary that you're going to be there that might see your panel. And now, you know, we, our first book, we had 7 different events in 7 different cities with like 8 or 9 different authors. And like, you know, it's not always necessarily like huge people that are coming out for them, but they also will live in posterity. And so, you know, the chances of, there was one reading where it was like, we had like, you know, somebody from Singapore, somebody from London, somebody from like, you know, South America, and then like a bunch of people from different places around the country who they might never get book events for, especially a debut author in their locale. So that's all really nice.
It sounds like with the, like, if done right, it really can give you more reach potentially, like just because it's shaking things up to where you can't do the in-person events, but you're also not really stuck putting all of your time into those in-person events as far as promotion. So you can, like you said, find those other tricks and find other ways to reach people. What are you thinking, like, as far as your, as far as Erewhon, because it's odd timing, you know, you come out with your first book and then immediately everything changes. The rug kind of gets pulled out from under you as far as the standard way of doing things. So what are your goals for, like, how do you see Erewhon as standing out, like, as a publisher? What is it that you do in terms of who you publish, your catalog that you're looking to have in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. So our mandate is sort of, we're attempting to publish kind of all speculative fiction, but we're using speculative fiction very advisedly because we're trying to do things that are somewhere in between, basically on the literary end of science fiction and the fantastical end of literary fiction. Another way of looking at that is that we're just trying to do things that are really high quality, like kind of imagining that every book on our list could be an award contender for just one of the finest speculative fiction books that's out there, which I really is like a big lofty thing to say, but you know, we have, I think, both Sarah, my co-editor, and I have some experience with like defining things that wind up being standouts in the genre. So we have a small enough list that hopefully everything can have that kind of like unique and special appeal. And I think the distinction of going for the specifically really like high quality side of things is a little bit different than any other house that might kind of have a combination of like, these are super commercial things, these are the weird things, and like often the things that are kind of the oddball things are always going to be a certain percentage of another house list. That's our entire list. And so there's some other small presses that like Tachyon and Small Beer Press that do similar things to what we're doing. So beyond that, I think it's just a lot of like, you know, editorial feeling, and like I can't always describe the kind of book that we're going to like, but I know that they're all really different from each other. So, you know, you've got to expect from a catalog that is going to be a bunch of different books that are both not like what other publishers are publishing and not like each other.
Okay. Yeah. Good variety. That's... and definitely the highest of quality. And you mentioned that having worked on stuff that's known for significant literary merit. And the one that comes to mind for me immediately is the Three Body Problem. You must have known we were probably going to get into that, talking about that.
not so weirdly, but it's become like the most prominent thing that I've done by a mile. Mm-hmm. It was also completely unexpected that when I started out, I spent a good year just trying to convince people that anyone would read a million plus word Chinese science fiction epic. Like it seemed very improbable at the time. It sort of still seems improbable now, but like, I loved it and therefore we did it. And sometimes everything that happens after you publish a book is like beyond anything that you can actually control for.
You had to do some work selling that idea, it sounds like, really.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Because for people that don't know the background of it, yeah, it's written by a Chinese author. It is very long. And it's nothing like that had really been given. Well, tell me if I'm wrong, you know this better than I do, but it hadn't really been given the time of day, nothing like this so far by the major publishing houses. And they probably had their preconceived notions of how this would do and what it looked like as a business proposition. So what did you have to do to change that? I mean, how did you, because I assume you ended up having to sell this thing yourself in a lot of ways.
So I think that the probably the biggest factor there is translation. Was I am in retrospect, like almost like our genre was in a sort of retrograde place with regards to anything outside of our experience, and you know, like everything has shifted so much in the past few years. Not only in terms of like increasing all kinds of representation, but like embracing other things. But there was a while where many people who were, you know, good readers, read everything in fiction, would just be like, I don't read translations. I don't, you know, like that. I'm not into that. And that was an acceptable thing to say and feel. And I think I'm sure that some people still feel that way, but there had just been nothing that was a crucial translation to read, really, outside of like, you know, let's say classics like Gabriel Garcia Marquez or things of that sort. We had, prior to the Three Body Problem, there was, if I can recall correctly, I think that maybe 100 Years of Solitude was a World Fantasy nominee, but aside from that, no work in translation had been nominated for any of the major awards. Wow. Maybe a few short story nominations, but it was just like these works were not getting recognized. And that to me is really sad, that there are really significant and powerful speculative fiction traditions in just about every country of the world that like has enough people to write there. And just by a virtue of people feeling like it's not going to sell, things are either, were either just not picked up. It's also hard and expensive to do translation. Yeah. So they just like would largely not find a platform. And then when they did, the expected audience would be a tiny fraction of the, even something that is immensely popular in its home country, like The Three Body was, like just people wouldn't expect it. So yeah, I think at the beginning I was like almost like back-channeling the translation aspect, and I was talking about the fact that Ken Liu is a translator and he was getting prominence for his own writing career, so I'd like play up his profile. And I think I just talked about the fact that it is like really big idea hard science fiction, the kind of like golden age science fiction that a lot of people really love and respond to, and we just don't have very much of these days. So I would play up the aspects that were not necessarily about the like the full story behind it. But when you're publishing a thing, you've got to find what you think will connect it to the most readers.
Right. Is that one of the things that you guys try to push is getting those translations out there so people can, you know, be exposed to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really important, both like for, you know, reminding us that we're not, America is not the only country, that there's like many other things going on. But I think also in terms of like being a reader who is exposed to all kinds of things, that clearly there's a very wide range of publishing that happens in English. But it is a small part of a global publishing tradition where sometimes the expectations and the kinds of writing are very different than what we do here. So I think that we are losing out by not looking at the global stage.
Absolutely.
That's right.
So can we look at the editing side of things? Say I have no clue what an editor does. And I walk in and say, hey, Liz, can you tell me what you do? What does an editor do?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I guess there's kind of two parts of that. And one is the actual editing. And that's the kind of thing that people can assume that we'll go through and basically like starting from the beginning of the manuscript, kind of read it and like talk about it from a structural and character perspective and like ask the writer to revise it and then take it back and then maybe do some line editing of the work. And that's all really important. I love doing that. It's probably 10 to 20% of what we do. And the other parts of that are being a project manager for the book, being a booster for the book, selling the book to other people, and also acquisitions, building up the list. And so in practically any house, somebody is going to spend the most of their time, like imagine almost all of, when we would go into an office, almost all of my office time would be spent kind of doing the things that are like the interfacing of the book. How do we explain this? What is the copy that we're writing? What is the, you know, cover look like? Where do we think we're going to do the cover reveals, or like, you know, like into talking to the publicity department and the production department and all the other spaces like about how we best serve this book and how we get it out there. And then some amount of like selling of the house, that like even a house like Tor still needs kind of folks to sort of stand up and like talk about what it's doing in the world. And a house like Erewhon especially is just kind of a lot of communication about who we are and what we do. The job outside of that does change a little bit in different places. And now I'm wearing a few different hats. I am the publisher, and like, so that brings with it a whole other set of things. But even my other editor at Erewhon, when you're a four-person house, you wind up doing a lot of things that are not necessarily on the label. So up until about 2 or 3 months ago, we were also basically acting as the sort of like legal department doing the primary contract negotiations. Wow. We were also art directing all of our books. And we were doing basically the production work for all of our books. Like the main, we would have a production editor, but it was, you know, just because we didn't have other folks to do that stuff, we were stepping in on that. And who began to realize that just we didn't have enough time to sit down and do the editing and do the reading. And so I've now moved two of those things off of our lap, but we still do art directing because we both really like doing that and think it's fun. So right. We're sticking with that for a little while.
Right. Is there a big difference between editing novels versus comics?
Yes, I've only done two or three full-length works of comics and a bunch of short comics, and I think that the difference is primarily going to be, first of all, the amount. I feel like it's an iceberg thing that in novels, it's almost the most direct translation between, let's say, a singular vision and what the recipient sees, in that every word that is in a book is going to hopefully get read by somebody that's reading it. Right. In comics, you're still working on vast majority of work that is kind of the script is comprises only a small percentage of kind of the labor that goes in there. So when you're editing a script, like starting from the beginning of that, you will be paying attention to the specific words that fit in the balloons. And you'll be thinking about, okay, does this panel description make sense? But then you will spend a ton of time thinking about, okay, now we're going to like look at thumbnails. Like, is the visual vocabulary coming across here? Looking at the final art and being like, is this legible? Like, does this make sense? So you spend a lot more time there kind of thinking of the visual presentation side of things. And the actual words are, 10% of that.
That's an interesting career arc you've had, from comics to tour to literary fantastical. That's you kind of have covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, I guess to some extent, though, there's so many kinds of books, and they're all like very, very disparate from each other, that it does feel like a similar corner of the universe. But I got into publishing because I wanted to make comics to begin with. Like, when I was in college, I spent almost all of my recreational reading was comics. I really loved it. I was excited by it. And so I started there. And I still do love it, but I just spent a lot less time on it. But at the time, like, I suddenly occurred to me one day that people had jobs where they worked on comics, and that sounded like the most exciting thing. And I sort of wound up interning at Tor by accident, and just turned out that was also a thing that I really loved. And ultimately, I think I do like editing prose books a little bit better than liking comics, but some of that is just like, I don't know, just like all the other things that go along with it, then it feels more like a kind of holistic thing. And I'm honestly less confident about, I'm less confident about editing pictures, as it were, because I'm not an artist. I am a pretty good, prose writer at the line level. So I can say relatively confidently, like, this just doesn't sound good, but right. I can't draw for anything. And so if I'm like, got to tell an artist, like, who actually knows what they're doing, hey, like, this doesn't look very good. That's like, feels a little presumptuous to me.
Well, it sounds like regardless of what you're editing, there's a, what's striking me about that is that it seems really like it's probably really enjoyable to have a certain sense of ownership of the thing, like of the entire package, like the entire universe of the book, because you have the writer who's, not that this is all they have to consider, but they're concerned primarily with the prose and with the content of the book. Mm-hmm. You have a significant effect on the content of it, but also on what it's going to look like, who it's going to sell to, who's going to put it out, what its place is going to be in the market. Is that something that you particularly enjoy, is like visualizing where you want this book's, where you want it to be as a finished product, and what place you want it to have in the market?
Yeah. I like some aspects of it. And the thing that I like less is like the actual, like selling a book as a product. That can sometimes be a little bit demoralizing, because you need to, like, honestly, just like, it shaves a lot of the subtlety out of the picture. But I do really like thinking about how to connect a book to its ideal readers. And some of that is the visual communication of just the first thing that they're going to see is the picture on the cover. Some of that is, who are the comparisons that you draw, like knowing the market well enough to kind of figure out where does this fit in the whole like picture of speculative fiction and or literary fiction, and like wherever you're going to find it. And then finding ways to talk about it that like I think really do kind of get to the I feel very lucky to have, like, in our partner, our distributor, which is Workman Books, they had never done But they'd done one science fiction and fantasy book before we came on board. Uh-huh. They'd published Good Omens back in the day.
Oh, wow.
That was their one book. And then wow. took a little break. And so I was a little bit nervous initially, kind of like, how would it go over talking to them about like this genre that I hold dearly? But they just like totally, you know, were really excited to learn about it. And so I think that that was like part of the art of like, not only, I guess it's a lot of like, sometimes you have to do the double work of first, let's connect this to the sales team in my own house while realizing that the ultimate reader is going to be very different than that sales team.
Right.
And that can be kind of frustrating because there's things where it's kind of like the vocabulary that I would use to like talk about the specific subgenre of this book and why it's going to excite people. Like a book that has like, you know, really good physics is not necessarily going to, you know, excite your salesperson. But I think that with our current arrangement with Workman, it really has felt like we have been able to pretty much just talk about like kind of like why we love these books and like what subgenres that they inhabit. And by and large, that's the same argument that we'd use to promote it to a reader.
It sounds like your actual love of the genre itself and the various subgenres, that's a big part of selling it. Like it seems like people are always going to be it, but they're most effective in terms of selling when they truly believe in the product. So I think it sounds like that actual real sounds like a lifelong love of comics and science fiction and fantasy is probably partially key to, you know, you being able to do this job well. So is it really a lifelong, I mean, did you grow up reading this stuff or was there something in particular that brought you to speculative fiction?
Yeah, so I've read it my whole life. And I went through periods of when I was a kid, I guess my first science fiction love was Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And like, I read Lewis Carroll, Roald Dahl, like, so definitely read a lot of it when I was younger. I went through a few different phases. I went through like a little bit of a mystery period. But I would say when I was like 12 or 13, like that was when I found the adult science fiction section of my library. And like, that was just all I read for a little while. So I do really love it. Like, I think that pretty much any media that I take in, except maybe like weird experimental theater, I'm always going to like it more if there's like something speculative. So yeah, it's definitely my flavor in life. And I think it is largely true that like the love is like useful. The only downside is I will admit that I'm like a little bit, it's always tricky talking about kind of like the commercial balance of something, because I think that a lot of things can sell lots of copies that are not necessarily your commercial mainstays. Mm-hmm. I'm also not a big fan of some of the biggest and most commercial genres. Like I read a lot of epic fantasy for a while. It's not my thing anymore. I just like, you know, I think it because I've seen not only so read so many books in the genre, but like also just like read so much bad slush that is like of that genre that it's just like not a thing that I want to publish. And I think similarly, like with, I don't do much, let's say classic straight down the line space opera or military SF or things, genres that sell tons of copies, like just not my bag. So I can't necessarily make a comparison to our giant bestsellers. So it's always a question of like, finding, and I think that the world has helped with that in that make a lot of comparisons to media these days, because like when we're talking about weirdo, let's say weirdo time travel narratives, like everybody's seen Russian Doll. So we can kind of talk about like, if you love this thing, I don't need to compare it to Star Wars. I can compare, I don't need to even compare it to Game of Thrones. I can say, hey, that weird miniseries that you saw, like, you know, it's a lot like that.
Right.
That's cool. It gives you a lot more room for comparisons, which I understand are a pretty, you know, something that you just have to do. You have to have comparisons. That's a standard thing. But yeah, I hadn't thought about that before, that you're not having to go and you don't have to find a novel that's well known that you can compare it to and say, it's a lot like this, but it's different enough that I think you should still buy it.
Right. Like there's like hot, there's like she said, a show in like almost every type of science fiction, where you can say it's kind of like this or it's kind of like that. And it kind of gets, I don't know, I guess it's the best way to get to people who don't normally read, you know, try to find a door into where they can, you know, try to, you know, make them fans into their fandom. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know if like all of you in your lives like have experience with people that don't read science fiction and fantasy. That's gotten better over the years, but I spent a long time with like relatives that would be like, "Oh yeah, I don't read that stuff." And I'm like, "But A, you do because you read 1984, you read Frankenstein, like you secretly like this kind of thing." But also like just increasingly like it's now just like by far if it's like something like 199 of the 200 top grossing films are science fiction or fantasy. And so I think some people can be a little bit like, oh, like we want to make a distinction between written and film media. But I think honestly, we've got to find people sort of where they are. And it seems strange to me that plenty of people that will watch something will not pick up a book with that is specifically science fiction and fantasy. But that's where we are. So we've got to counteract that like however we can.
It does feel like it is getting a little better. I remember 15, 20 years ago, people were like, oh no, like it had to be very, very literary, you know? Like we don't read that because that's, and I never quite understood what the problem was with it. Okay, sorry about that.
I feel the same way. Like I'm totally with you on that one. Because that's, you know, I grew up reading literally the first thing that the books that I learned to read on were the Chronicles of Narnia. So I was just portal fantasy from the beginning, you know, like, and just loved reading science fiction and fantasy. But for, you know, I mean, I grew up in the 80s, and yeah, that was definitely before people had were taking it seriously. And that's something that was always a source of frustration for me was that I'm like, but if you read the right stuff, I'm like, let me loan you some books and you'll see that you really are missing out. Like you're, it's not that this isn't for kids. This isn't trash. This isn't less, this doesn't have less merit. It's just as strong. And in a lot of time, you know, in a lot of cases, even stronger if you just get past the label on the shelf that you picked it up from, you know, if you can just ignore that. It's good to hear that it's getting a little bit better. And I was wondering what you mentioned earlier that you see like a lot of things changing, a lot of new voices being able to find a place and find some recognition. You have the inside track on that. Like there's something that we at Multiverse keep up with quite a lot as much as we can. But what are you seeing as far as recent changes and kind of the track you think things are taking in that regard?
So I think that there's kind of a few threads that are going on. Some of it is that there's like been a I feel like the longer picture is like the social justice sphere within science fiction and fantasy, and like has always existed, but has definitely kind of been figuring out, let's say, like figuring out tactics for a little while. And I don't want to go too much into, let's say, what is not exactly ancient history, but the sometimes I think that the like things that science fiction and fantasy have gone through are like sort of microcosm for what America is going through. And so when we went through the sad puppies and rabid puppies thing, like that was, I think, a little bit before it was both like it was very new at the time. And then I think it immediately became like recapitulated in Gamergate and recapitulated in like a lot of the white supremacy movements that have like taken over the world. And so it was very interesting to kind of watch like how science fiction was. There was a few dark years in there where we're like, oh gosh, what do we do? Like we have these people in our midst, like how do we respond to that? And I think that some of the ways, like both watching people find each other over social media, like have a lot of really hard discussions. Starting even a little bit before that with something like big you know, genre things like Race Fail, and then like moving on to kind of places where like WisCon is my, I would say, home con, and there's like the very specific intent about having a lot of difficult conversations, both about like the place of the con and like how it can kind of be a stage to make more people more comfortable and more people included in that conversation, but also like how we then go and turn people that are like both that want the genre to expand and grow, and how they wind up having a kind of a voice in like what the genre looks like. And so some of that was the early work, and some of this might look a little bit like log rolling, but just kind of like very specifically, like let's nominate the works that we love that are not the most mainstream thing, that are not the like the kind of military SF that like is what old SF used to look like. There's some, you know, tentpoles of the genre that I still really love, but also we've grown a lot since then. So I think having the the awards reflect more progressive movement within the genre started to open that up a little bit. And then I think over the past few years, it's been things like really great movements like We Need Diverse Books, POC yes. and Pub, and like I guess like parts of the Black Lives Matter movement that have like kind of influenced just like what are you doing to stand up for this within any sphere that you have influence in, either as a writer or a publisher or an editor. It's interesting to see basically how that has kind of very tangibly affected both for a while. It was like what we were able to do. At the beginning of my career, I had like a book with gay protagonists, and I would sort of secretly talk about that to the people that I thought would like it, which was not 90% of the people that I worked with. It's kind of the thing where you'd like use the diversity as a secret selling point. And then gradually I'd be able to like bring that as a, you know, put it down as like the fourth or fifth key selling point and be like, oh, people that want the gay stuff, they can find it in this book. Not so much that it would get like moved to the GBLT section and not be found by anybody, which is a terrible thing to say, but it is a calculus. You've got to figure out how to walk that line. And then over the past few months, especially, it's like actually turned into, it's a mandate. Everybody is like, we've got to increase representation on our list. We've especially got to increase the number of Black authors on our list. And, the only downside of that is that people are getting paid a lot more money. It's a lot harder as an indie house to compete in that kind of thing. But ultimately that's amazing that I think that there's just like, even it's a little bit sad that there had to be a national movement to be a corrective for that kind of thing. And everybody's a little bit nervous that it might not last forever, but while it's happening, it's great.
And hopefully it's something where, it doesn't fade away. Hopefully it's something where people, through this additional promotion and platforming and representation, more people, more fans find these things that they hadn't read before and find authors and read stories about people that they're not used to reading about. And hopefully the effect of that, even if it's more of a burst right now, is that it won't fade away, but turn into something where, okay, now I'm used to that. Now I'm comfortable with that. And also now I know this group of authors. And if I follow them on Twitter, they're going to tell me about other authors that they recommend that write similar stuff. And hopefully it'll continue to spread out from there. There has been a lot in the last few months, like the publishing paid me hashtag. That was an interesting one. One of our previous guests, Elle McKinney, started that, and it was perfectly timed, I thought, because the disparities that showed were shocking, upsetting to a lot of folks. But I guess that's what happens when you pull back the curtain a little bit. Although now, like you said, there's more money being paid out all over the place, and certainly for what you want to do, there's more equity there. But as a brand new house, it adds to your competition, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to go. I have hope. I don't think it's going to go away. I don't think it's going to fade away. I think there have been enough quality works to go, okay, yes, this is it. This is where it needs to be. I'm more afraid of it being washed away in the sense of, hey, we have to meet this quota. We have to have this. And then they start to fill the market with people who aren't putting quality material up. You understand what I'm saying? And that's my biggest fear. My biggest fear is that other people won't be seen for some companies to try to reach. How do you navigate that? How do you navigate trying to put quality people up, but also trying to expose others to diverse materials?
So I think some of that is just genuinely kind of like really being excited by what new voices are bringing to the table. And so it, it hasn't been an issue for me, I think, because I think I've often been most excited by somebody is because we're looking for things that are really interesting and really different than what's out there.
Right.
So for a long time, that would just dovetail with the people that were bringing the most interesting voices were often sometimes the most underrepresented voices because right. they weren't trying to tell the same stories that other people were.
Right.
I do think it's like, as with anything that is like a trend in any form, mm-hmm. sometimes you do wind up kind of like getting a little bit oversaturated, but we're also like, we've got a lot of good writer. We've got a lot of good writers before we get to even the middle of the barrel. So, there's a lot of catching up that we need to do in like, right. Many places that we kind of need to look like to, and also it's while it does, like, I think that, that kind of publishing seems really prominent right now, partially because mm-hmm. a lot of it's doing really well. I haven't seen the recent statistical numbers, but we have a long way to go. That we're yeah, still right. There's still tons of white cis straight people being published. Like, we're not in danger of running out of that anytime soon. Right, the yes. publishing industry is still enormously white, and so like there's plenty of time for this for things to get better before they become even close to parity.
Right, right.
Well, that raises an interesting question because there's something that some of our friends have talked about a lot, which is that when people are going to look for, like, say that it's come to a reader's attention, I've been reading the exact same type of people, the same characters, the same authors for a long time. I need to broaden my horizons. A lot of times people come up with, they'll come across N.K. Jemisin, they'll come across Nnedi Okorafor, and maybe one or two others, the bigger names, and then they kind of stop. And I don't know where else to look. Or, they don't realize how much more is out there. Do you have any suggestions for people on, aside from Erewhon, of course, because that's going to be a great place to follow and watch for different types of fiction. But do you have any recommendations for how people can find, just the average reader, how can you find something to really get outside of your lane?
Sure. Yeah. I think I do, like, our major awards are all, I think, like, I don't have a huge amount of time to read the things that I'm not working on, but right. From the little that I've read of, like, a lot of the people that are getting kind of that kind of acclaim and recognition, they're like, there's a lot of amazing stuff out there that you can find just by looking at your best novel. And like, and if you want to read short fiction, like, all the better. Like, there's tons of mm-hmm. material there, for anybody to kind of like find new folks to get excited about. And I think we're really lucky in science fiction and fantasy for having a pretty healthy anthology market. And like, so you can these days kind of find like a number of anthologies about sort of almost anything that you want and an emphasis on. The for a while, I feel like the Queer People Destroy science fiction and fantasy and horror, Disabled People Destroy, like, just basically, like, I think that there's enough people that are kind of like attempting to surface this kind of work that you can find something that focuses on your specific subgenre and your specific group of writers that you want to see more representation of, and like, try that, see what sticks out. All of this is going to take a little bit of work. And I think sometimes when people are like, I can't find this, they're ultimately saying, I don't want to do the work. I'm like, right. I don't know. I don't know how to solve that for them. But
that's, yeah, you said what I was shying away from saying. That's what they're really saying when they say, I don't know where else to look. It's saying I'm not putting in the effort to actually go look. But those are great suggestions. People can go yes. and read, like, look up the Hugos, the Nebulas, the Locus Awards, the World Fantasy Awards, and read the nominees, not just the winners. Yeah, those are great lists. I agree with that. And also what you said about anthologies, I grew up absolutely loving anthologies because I discovered so many great authors that way. And that's a great point because I hadn't thought about it, but I'm seeing, on the people I follow on Twitter and stuff, there are so many anthologies lately, like you mm-hmm. said, that are just about anything, like whatever your particular interest is, just go check out an anthology and you'll find there are too many for you to actually read. So I think those are great suggestions.
That's really a good problem to have.
Yes.
Well, and speaking of Hugos, you've had 7 nominations. Is that right? And you won.
Yeah. Enough to lose track.
That's a good problem to have. so you won in 2017, is that right? In Helsinki.
So, yeah, sorry, no, there's not my strong point.
That's all right. So what was that experience like?
That was very wild. I think because I clearly gotten in the habit of losing, so I just kind of expected that I would do that for a while. But the Hugos are really fun. It's been a while since I had the kind of normal spectator experience. I've gotten a little bit spoiled of just being able to go and so when you are nominated, there's a pre-party, and then
Nice.
the you get to sit in fancy seats for the actual ceremony
Yeah.
if you're at the Worldcon. And then for a while there was there was some kind of post party, but then George R. R. Martin has been hosting the after party for the past few years. And it's kind of sweet. I would say publishing by and large is a much less glamorous profession than people think, but that's kind of the night where you get to dress up and be fancy with your fancy friends. And it's just fun. So honestly, I think that a lot people will have the experience of kind of you are, even if you don't think you have any chance, you're really nervous up until the point at which your category is announced, and then you can relax and have fun. So it's I don't know. I think it's just a chance to, I think for a lot of us who are maybe doing work that people in our immediate sphere don't always understand, just having a thing where you're suddenly all of this weird late night toil that you've been doing for the past year or past 10 years is finally getting recognized in some fashion.
Some validation there. Right.
Yeah, no kidding. Because, like you said, you're just toiling away. It's a solitary job a lot of the time. Especially when you're doing the actual prose editing, like you were talking about. What do you, like, considering that you not only do the prose editing, but you do the business side of things and all the other things you mentioned, what do you do to keep from burning out? Like, what do you do to relax and have fun?
So right
Or do
now,
you?
not very much. But I think when I was starting this, I was kind of figuring that I would spend a few years where this was the main thing. So I don't know. And it's a weird world, right? That you can't do a lot of the things that you would normally do to kind of blow off steam right now. My spice cabinet is in very good shape right now. Productive procrastination, things of that sort. And I think, it is, I feel lucky to have a job where a lot of the work is fun. So it's I feel okay kind of that being the main thing that I'm doing right now.
It seems like it's overall just really rewarding. I think a lot of that's probably resonates with a lot of people who will be watching this, because they're, if you're involved in a convention like this, that means you have some significant appreciation for science fiction and fantasy, and that the fact that you are doing the work to get it out there and to make it as good as it can be and to put the best stuff out there, that's got to be very rewarding. What would you say to people who want to get into the publishing side of things that maybe aren't looking to write, but actually want to do something like what you do? What would you tell them?
So the point that you just made, I think centers on it sort of exactly. And one of the first pieces of advice that I got is don't do this unless you can't do anything else. And I think that applies to writing as well, kind of any involvement that you're going to have in this, and it's not can't in a literal sense. I'm sure most writers, most publishers, they could do all manner of things, but it's hard enough, and it's there's enough kind of enough of a slog, enough being underpaid that you really you've got to really love it to get through the parts that are hard. And so I think that there's a lot of folks that sort of look at publishing and they're like, hey, I get to make books, it's super fun. And there are some parts of it that are fun, and then there are some parts of it where you're going to be, potentially in a big expensive city, being underpaid for a really long amount of time, and so you've got to love it in order to get through the hard periods. And so you see a lot of folks that start out in publishing because they often have an English degree and they're not sure what to do with it, and try it out for a few years. We always say 5 years is one of the breaking points where suddenly somebody's like, wait a minute, I could be a paralegal and make twice as much, or practically anything. So I think that the folks that stick with it are really care enough about it for books to be their life.
Yeah, seems like that does sound like that would need to be the case, and it sounds like it has been for you. How long have you when you first started to intern, how long have you been doing it? Like the total time since then?
Yeah, it's like 17 years now.
Yeah, 17 years. So yeah, that's, and in all the different different ways that you've done it and different places that you've done it, you definitely seem to have found your love for it. And I know that we're definitely appreciative of that work. That's something that if you talk to writers, they never underappreciate their editors, at least not publicly. And I really don't think personally.
Yeah.
Because they, and that's something that we hope more people who maybe aren't in the industry recognize, is that these books that you love and the movies that you love that come from them and all that, they don't happen without really great editing work and people to get behind these books and shape them up and sell them and, you know, advocate for them. So I just know that our whole community is really appreciative of the work that you do and are continuing to do with Erewhon. We're really hoping for great things for your house, especially once things start to get back to normal. Are you going to go back to doing the major book events and everything like that? Do you think the landscape's going to look different after this?
I mean, yes, but I think it's like, I talk a lot with my friends about like, what is it going to take to get you to do a normal thing? And like, a lot of that is like, at this point, we've kind of got to have a vaccine and we've got to like, some significant things are going to change before it feels like, you know, responsible to do something like that. So just trying not to rush it too much and see where things go. And it's I think it's going to be a long haul, which is sucks, but that's where we are right now.
Yes, and that's why we have these conversations, so that we don't, at least we're not doing it entirely alone.
Right.
It's true.
Yeah, right. Well, thank you so very much for taking time out of your schedule to talk to us about all this. And we're really hoping to see you next year in Atlanta. And we're really looking forward to that this year, but you know, along with many other things that just didn't manage to happen. But yes, thank you a lot for your time. Where can people find you and find Erewhon, and what do you want them to know if they look for you online?
Yeah. So I've got a little book stack. I'm going to do the thing.
Yeah. Just please do. Yes. Say.
First book that came out is The Fortress by S.A. Jones. And then we just released a few weeks ago, The Scapegracers. This is our first YA book by Hannah Abigail Clark. Really excellent, like witchy lesbian book. And in about a week, or probably on your shelves now, this is The Midnight Bargain by C.L. Polk. I love all of these books, and like, I hope you will too. If you're the kind of person that's watching this, you probably will be. And we are Erewhon Books. That's Erewhon Books, and .com is our website, and we're on with the same handle on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
Excellent.
And can awesome. I give props to the art direction there? So you're saying you enjoyed it. You guys did a great job. Those are great.
Thank you so great much. Those are great covers, right?
Yeah. Nice. I've been seeing that Scapegracers cover all over the place. It's just that's, people have been sharing it around even not knowing much about the book. They're like, hey, did you see this?
Right.
Thank you so much. The artist is Uncle of Riv, who is a tattoo artist who has never done commercial illustration before.
That's
she's amazing.
Pretty cool.
Cool. Thinking innovatively, crossover. That's how you get cool
right.
stuff.
That's right.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for watching. And Liz Guernsey, thank you so much for being here and doing this with us. And we wish you all the best in your future endeavors.
Oh, thank you so much for your time.
Yes. Bye, everyone.
Bye, guys.
Take it easy, guys.